So I said 15 minutes was too long, and now I'm finding 10 minutes is not enough. So I guess we'll have to get on this. But let's finally get into a little bit into scanning, since I promised you we'd start on that. So again, what I'm talking about now will be relevant to Project 2. If you want, Project 2 is out and released, both in terms of the paper definition and also a downloadable version of a simple scanner and so on. So I'm going to always try to keep out. I should have the parser out very soon, if not this week, early next, because I understand people have to travel. I know one person is going to New York, that toddling town, fortunately, after the snowfall. So some of you, I know some people luck out. I know one person went to someplace in Florida, which would be a great place to be, and somebody went to Abu Dhabi, and I guess what the company does some business in the Middle East, and I don't know, you know, somehow going to Abu Dhabi is not on the top of the list of, on my bucket list, it's way down. So, but as long as they pay you for it, that's fine. But the notion is that as soon as I start talking about something, you're more than welcome to look at the assignment and start asking questions or thinking about how do my lectures tie into what I'm asking you to do. At this stage, we're just getting into the basics of scanning. And as I promised earlier, this odd notion that we have all sorts of notation for doing numbers, things like square roots and exponentials and even imaginary numbers, but we have a relatively imprecise and crude way of talking about something that is much more familiar, namely strings, be it as something as simple as doing a crossword puzzle analysis or something more complex like trying to take incomplete data. And again, people do that all the time. There's some extremely clever and complex analysis done on very ancient data. You may have heard of something called the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are go back, their holy scriptures go back, I think, to pre-BC times, you know, 2,000 years plus back. And these things, as you imagine, being that old, they're in terrible shape. And ink is faded, things are broken away, and you get sort of partial here and partial there. And yet computer scientists and linguists have put together and are able to do sort of matching. And again, if you understand Hebrew, you know, they were able to say, what Hebrew letter is this? It could be this or it could be that. If this were this and that were that, would that make sense? And they've been able to analyze a lot of the Dead Sea Scrolls much more thoroughly with the aid of computers. But still, it's a situation. Those are letters and symbols, and we really don't have much in the way of notation for saying that, you know, here's something that looks like this particular letter could be, I think there's a Hebrew letter called Aleph, and you know, Bet or Better or something, you know, this could be this and this could be that, and would they fit together? And yet you can do some really great research and really great science based on that. So we're not going to certainly supersede that. But what we are going to do is, remember, a scanner simply is going to read characters. So at the simplest level, we're going to call the scanner with the name of a file, just a text file, and it's going to read those letters, try to build tokens out of them, and possibly introduce some error messages if it sees unexpected characters or it sees tokens which, for some reason, seem to be illegal or improper. Just terminology-wise, I call it a scanner, but lexical analyzer is certainly a common name. JLEX, the name of the thing we're using, is J is for Java, and Lex is for lexical analyzer, or sometimes it's called a lexer. And I guess, what, Lex is Latin for word, is that correct? Anybody study Latin? I'm not sure. So, you know, it goes way back, but so we're going down to the root of words. The thing I was alluding to is that the crude way to write a scanner would be to write a series of if statements and loops and switches that say, if I see an A, do this. I see a B, do that. If I see a C, do that. That'd be possible. But those things get to be very tricky because different characters can be used in different contexts. For example, if I see something like IF, or let's say I simply see I could say, if I was programming this by hand, oh, that's probably an identifier. If I see IF, that might be an if statement, which is a reserved word. But wait a minute, if I have a couple of slashes out here, it's neither. It's part of a comment. Or what if it's the case that I happen to have quotes around it? Then it's a string. Or what if I have single quotes around it? then it's illegal, probably, because single quotes in most languages mean a character, and a character is one character long. But wait a minute, it turns out that some characters are spelled out with multiple characters. So I could write down backslash n, and that's two characters long as we write it, but it represents one character, namely the unprintable character new line, which is usable, and you probably use that a lot in your programming. You sometimes add a new line so you can do some, you could break a long line into a series of shorter lines to make it easier to read and print out. Oops, do it again. So having some way of specifying what tokens matter is very important. In fact, we're going to come up with a very cool system that has a property that you almost never have seen before and very rarely see. In the old days, when I was first learning programming, we actually programmed in punch cards. And probably none of you have ever touched punch cards, but you've seen them and old movies and all that. And back in those days, our great fear would be the way you carried around a program, quite literally, was a deck of cards with rubber bands around them. And I would always put two or three or four rubber bands down. And the great fear would be walking along and the deck falls out of our hand, hits the floor, rubber bands burst, and you have all these cards scattered about. And you are dead meat. Why? Well, it's because the same thing in almost all programming languages, the order in which statements are made makes a difference. But guess what? In scanning, to a pretty general extent, if I write a definition here, say a definition of token one, and write a definition of token two, and then token three, you can shuffle those definitions and it won't matter. It's rather much like if you have a dictionary that defines words, you put it in a sorted order to make it easy to find. But I have a definition of what cat means and a definition of what dog means, whether one comes first or not, doesn't matter. And think of how few programs you have, no matter what language they're in, where I can shuffle around completely the lines. So that means if I had a Java program, I could put the header line for main down at the bottom and the closer up top. In fact, I could put it backwards. So it's like a language where I read from bottom up instead of top down. Almost no languages does that work. In this language, it almost works. There are a couple of cases where ordering makes a slight difference. But the reason why this makes very little difference is because these are definitions, and each definition stands alone. And it's the analyzer's responsibility to merge these definitions into a composite scanner that handles all of them. So it's almost rather, you know, like a police officer. All these things have rules. And all of a sudden you tell the police officer, if you see anybody that has a sticker from Epic, give them a ticket because we know they're rich and we need some money to buy the new library or to pay for snow plowing or something like that. And you laugh about that. But has anybody been to a place called Rosendale? Yeah. And what does Rosendale known for? Besides being a tiny little town that you can truly drive through in 30 seconds. No, you've been through, excuse me, yeah. They get a large part of their civic money by giving tickets to outsiders, which is virtually everyone. And it turns out, I know about it because it's right on the route from Madison to Oshkosh. And if you've never visited EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association, it is a great place to visit, and it's dead on the route. And everybody says, when you get close to Rosendale, slow the heck down, crawl along, and sure. Excuse me? Is it easy? It's what is it, 41 or something there? Right, that's right. There's a shortcut. You're right. You can say on 151 up to 41, or there's this little short, yeah. But they have this great diner in, what do they call it? Does anybody know what the diner is in Rosendale? Oh, Talbot's or something like that. It's a great diner. I mean, it's like going back 50 years. I mean, situation, the old diner and all that. So anyway, but that's the situation. So there's a case where they may not do it in Verona because I expect probably it's the case that Epic owns Verona, lock, stock, and barrel. But there's some places where they say, if you look like you're rich and you're an outsider, give them a ticket whether he or she deserves it or not, and we'll make some money. So there's an extra rule added in. We wouldn't, of course, do that in Verona, I hope, because I don't want to pay any extra tickets. So what we're going to do is come up with rules, like I showed you a bit ago, for various tokens. But the first question that came to mind when I learned about all this was, isn't this overkill? Tokens are real easy. They're like commas and semicolons and numbers and so on. But it turns out that when you get to a full language like Java or even CSS, there's all sorts of issues, and I touched upon some of them just a moment or two ago. Namely, suppose I'm doing strings. A string is delimited by double quotes in most languages. But what do I do if I want to have a double quote inside a string? Is it totally forbidden? Because if I wanted to have a quoted string that contained the double quote symbol, how would I do it? Well, it turns out that languages come up with some form of escape. The most common one is backslash and one or more magic symbols. So it turns out that in our language, we'll have a backslash double quote be an escape symbol that says, I'm not two characters, I'm one. I'm a double quote inside the string. But if you do that, you have to have a way to represent a backslash. And the way you do that is by a double backslash. It happens also that most strings want to have symbols which are not printable, but real useful inside quoted strings. One of them is a tab, and that's backslash T. Another is a new line, backslash N. And it turns out that if you're in the Windows world, you might want to have something called a carriage return, which is not quite a new line. And I think that's backslash, is it C or CR? Is anybody? I don't use it very much. Is it backslash C? I think it is. So languages will have all these escapes, but not everybody. There, for example, I don't think there's in any language a backslash percent sign, which means you probably have to complain about that, because this will be misinterpreted as a backslash that itself is not escaped. So even if something as simple as taking quoted strings and extending it to allow extra special symbols can make the definition of a token a little more complex than you would have imagined. So here's that new line character I talked about in backslashing. Some languages allow it, some languages don't. Our language will allow it to at least a reasonable extent. Even things like strings. Most strings allow, most languages, I should say, allow an empty string. That is double quote, is valid. So a string with nothing between the delimiters is valid. Why is that? Well, an empty string is a great initializer. If you want to have a string variable and you don't know what the content is, double quotes are a way of doing it. But some languages base strings not as sequences of characters, but as arrays of characters. And it turned out many early languages did not allow an array of length zero. And ask yourself, should we allow an array of length zero? Why would anybody, you're saying thumbs up? Yeah, okay. You got to be clear because there's another finger gesture that represents something different. So, yeah, but early languages didn't, because think about it. In fact, historically, if you ever study the history of mathematics, it was unbelievable the amount of discussion in the Middle Ages about whether zero was a number or not. We were all brought up, zero is a perfectly good number. You use it a lot. But in the Middle Ages, there was this argument, zero represents nothing. Numbers represent something. How can you intermix something with nothing? The argument for an array of length zero is, why would you ever allocate one? Because it's got nothing in it. And that's true. But as the gentleman here said, it makes sense, and most languages now allow it. And why would you allow an array of length zero? That's right. It's a situation there that it's a situation if you create an array of something that's a variable size. So you may have an array of, it's getting to be tax time. So you want to, you know, if getting to be tax time, you might not play this ploy of going out and buying an ant farm. And why would anybody buy an ant farm around the time of doing taxes? Well, ant farms have a lot of ants in them. And what are those little ants? They depend on you, therefore they're dependents. So you could say, I probably won't get away with it. You know, say, I have 678 dependents, these little ants crawling around, and without me, you know, they would not have whatever ants eat to keep them alive and healthy. So here's a case where the number of dependents might be very large, or it might be zero. You might, at this stage of your life, have no dependents. And you'd have a program simply allocate an array of, say, the Social Security numbers. And I don't know how you get a social security number for an ant, so don't ask me that. Maybe the guys that developed the ant software know about that, but I don't know how to do it. But see, there's a lot of philosophy built into programming languages. In a lot of cases, we implementing a language have to be sensitive to what should or should not be allowed. And again, an empty string or an empty array for uniformity, if nothing else, is allowed. But you don't carry that too far. You're not allowed to have an array of length minus one or a string of length minus one. I don't even know what that means, but you don't carry it that far. It's got to be nuanced in how you do it. So a little bit more about that. So what we're going to develop is a brand new notation. And this notation, if I change it here, called regular expressions. This is what I was promising you earlier. This is a notation that doesn't represent numbers, but represents single strings and sets of strings and patterns of strings. So I'll be able to write down a pretty nice pattern that says, here's a five-letter word. The first letter begins with a P. The first letter is a P. The last letter is a T. And in between there, I don't know what it is. And again, I could use that to solve a crossword puzzle, if nothing else. So just as I can write down an expression that represents a single number or a sequence of numbers, I can write down a pattern that represents a single string or a sequence of strings, possible strings, that are all related. So the thing I talked about a minute ago, there are some number of words, not an infinite number, but there's more than one word that begins with a P and ends in T and is five letters long. One of them, for example, is paint. Another is pilot. Another is pivot. And you're wondering how I know all these. It's because later on we're going to actually write a little program that does just that. And we're going to run it against a list of words and see about all the words we can find out that begin with P and end with T. Right now, in fact, I'm thinking about one that begins with a capital P and was originally prepared in Milwaukee. Does anybody know what that one is? Excuse me? Pabst, yeah, a friendly beverage, run a blue ribbon and all that. So, you know, be loyal to the state of Wisconsin and consume the product. But from our point of view, it's even better because we'll write those expressions and put them in a scanner generator. So in this case, I won't tell you how to match a quoted string. I'll give you a precise definition in regular expression notation that says, here's what a string looks like. Feed it into the generator and say, hey, you got to figure out how to match it. It doesn't have the right number of quotes. If I see a backslash, is it in the right context? Is it the right length? And you'll have to also be responsible for errors. For example, in our language, you'll not be allowed to have a string that crosses a line boundary. So I can't write down, hi, mom, on two physical lines. I can write it down using a new line, so I'm not really lost out. Why would you imagine I disallow that? Well, notice looking at that, I don't even know exactly what that string is. For example, how do I know there aren't a dozen blanks? And then here's where the new line is. So one of the things I don't like writing down something which visually seeing it doesn't tell me what I have. That's precisely why we have backslash tab and backslash new line. So that if this thing has a tab symbol in it, I can't see it. Remember, a tab expands out to some number of blanks. So if this thing has a tab in it, I want to be able to see a representation that says, oh, he put a tab in there and expect a tab-like behavior. So I want a program that I can visually see and understand what it means. So our rule will be that hi, mom, on two lines is illegal. How do I enforce that? The answer is I don't enforce it. The scanner does it. You may not like how it does it, but it will do it. And then I'll show you later how to have it handle things better. Sometimes you can find an error in an unexpected way, but it will find the error. Turns out that although we're going to talk about regular expressions in the context of a scanner generator, they're used in a lot of other cases and utilities. For example, has anybody ever used the grep utility? You're an old Unix person if you use grep. Grep, yeah, grep is a pattern matcher, and it uses patterns a lot. Turns out that Unix shells for files and so on use a regular expression-like notation. In fact, I kind of hate to admit it, but in the old days, we made our secretarial staff use Unix. Now, if you ever tried to use Linux, it's not the world's worst language, but it's not the best. So some people got into that really well, and others absolutely hated it. So I'd go in there and say, oh, this darn system, I'll never get a hang of it. So I would always tell them at the end of the day, don't worry about it. Here's a way to cure all your problems. If you ever have too many problems, just write this down and enter it in your computer and hit return, and all your problems go away. Now, what's happening is, let's go history. They didn't really ever do it, because I would usually come back and say, don't really do it, or something like this. But it turns out in Unix terminology, the first rule in Unix control words was never use two letters when you get one, or use three when you can use two. So RM doesn't mean rm, it means what? Remove, as in remove files. And here's the thing that's taken from regular expressions. Star is a wild card that matches anything and everything. So if you write down RM star, that can come close to purging your entire file system. It would certainly solve your problems, because there are no files, you don't have to worry about editing them. So if you really want to do a killer job, you have to do RM minus RF. And that's the one that really takes everything out, because R means do it recursively, not just take the top-level files, but take everything down to the subfiles. And F means force. If there's anything there that says, do you really want to do it? Force it and says yes. So I'm not saying do this, but here's something historically that really is regular expression notation, because if I had to write down the name of every last file, I could never do this. Remove file A, remove file B, remove file C. But this wildcard pattern allows me to do it in one fell swoop, maybe for worse rather than better. But the technology is there. And if you do that in your own system, don't tell your boss I told you to do it, because I'll deny it, and I have all these witnesses who will say I never ever would say anything like that. Oh, my battery's low, and that means that we get out of here sooner than we thought. Some editors also have something like that. If you use a text editor, there's ways, for example, to search for capital A or lower K, either one. So you can go in there, and in some cases, you can do a search slash something like that. And editors vary. Slash means search forward. The thing in square brackets means find me a T in either uppercase or lowercase, H-E. So it's a way of saying find me all the T-H-E's, but take into account that at the beginning of a sentence, there'll be an uppercase. So something like that. Those, if you've seen those in text editors, that's drawn upon the same notation. Windows Find, which I don't know much about, but somebody told me it had a really good way of doing that. So regular sets are the sets of strings that regular expressions define. So as it says there, I write down a regular expression. So the difference is the regular expression is a notation. It's like a square root symbol or so on. And the actual set is the actual number or sequence of numbers that the notation represents. So when we're scanning, a token class will be a regular set. That's typically because many different tokens have a large number of implementations. So if I talk about an integer literal, that can be a number with as many digits as I want. Or an identifier can be as long as I want. The old days of having an identifier only be 6 characters long or 10 characters long is gone. In many cases, you can even have identifiers with embedded blanks, although I'll show you how that can get you into trouble in a future lecture. Notation-wise, a particular instance of a token class is called an exeme. I don't like the notation. It sounds a tad too fancy. So we'll simply talk about all the strings that match a particular pattern as being tokens in that particular set. And a token, remember, is an individual one. Well, we have to start out at the beginning, and all scanners work on a particular vocabulary. The one we'll be using is the ASCII character set. That's the one that I think is in Windows and Mac and Unix. That's 128 characters, upper and lowercase letters, digits, and some other things as well. There's also something which, if you take a wider scope, that Java introduced something called Unicode, which is 2 bytes long, which is cool because it contains not just the Roman alphabet, but many other alphabets. It contains, for example, Hebrew and Arabic. It contains Cyrillic, which is the Russian one, Greek, which is not quite the same as Cyrillic. I believe Hindi or some version of Hindi is representable. There's a linearized version of Japanese, and I think a version of Chinese also that's linearized, and Persian and a lot of others. So the scanning technology I'm showing about, I'll be using conventional letters. But if you know some other language or have some home language, the technology works equally well for that. And a scanner that worked for Hebrew or Cyrillic Russian or Greek or something is certainly every bit as feasible. All that really is required is there be the individual characters in the set, and we represent what patterns we allow or disallow. Something that's important to understand is I talked a bit ago about zero, but it turns out we have to have an equivalent of zero for strings, and that's called the null string. The null string is a string that contains nothing at all. It's of length zero. Mathematically, it's oftentimes represented as lambda because these things were developed by mathematicians earlier. Equivalently, I talked about earlier, you could also think about it as the quoted string that has nothing between the quotes. So it might be odd that something like lambda is useful, but really not so much so because remember, zero is terribly useful. And let's see how we're doing on time. We're fine. A couple of minutes yet. So lambda is the cognate of zero. It's where we start out. When we start counting, we start out at zero. When we start building a string, we might start out with the null string and add character by character by character. But in some cases, we're allowed not to have a string at all. So for example, if I have a signed integer, I can have plus 1, 2, 3, or I can have minus 3, 4, 5. So I can write down an integer as having a prefix. And a prefix can be a plus or a minus. But many numbers have neither a plus nor a minus. Their prefix is no prefix at all. And one way of doing that is lambda. So one way to write down an optionally signed number is say you may have a plus sign, or you may have a minus sign, or you may have lambda, which is no sign at all. And any of those prefix combinations will work with an integer to give you a valid signed integer. So how do we build strings? The simplest way to build strings is by adding letters one by one. That's called catenation. Sometimes it's called concatenation, but so what we do is we take the alphabet sigma, say ASCII, and start grabbing characters. I can choose zero characters, that's the empty string, or one, or two, or three. And therefore I can build characters by adding them together. Notice we have the mathematical property that because lambda is the null string, it's essentially like zero. If you add zero to a number, you get the number. If you append a string S to lambda, either way, you get S because it's the empty string. You can also extend catenation to sequences of characters. So I could imagine having a set of valid prefixes and a valid suffixes. And sometimes you do that if you ever have to fill your name in on something. They say, what's your first name? What's your middle initial? What's your last name? And you have a prefix. Are you Reverend so-and-so? Or Professor so-and-so? Or Doctor so-and-so? And then you have a suffix, and there are various kinds of suffixes. You can have junior. You can have somebody to the third. I guess, you know, if you're in England, you can have somebody be ESQ, Esquire, etc. And essentially the pattern rule is take a valid name, like John Doe, and you could be Professor John Doe, or you could be Professor John Doe the third, and so on. And what they're really doing is taking the notion of sets of valid prefixes and suffixes and adding them together via catenation. Okay, there's a good place to stop because it just hit 8:20 and my battery is starting to complain again about being almost dead. So what we'll do next time is continue on scanning, and I'll have office hours on Thursday and next Monday, and the TA will have office hours on tomorrow, on Wednesday, so we may see you then.